This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. Today we hear from another candidate for Attorney General, the Libertarian candidate.
I'm sorry, I don't even know how to answer that other than a little bit of vomit coming up in my throat. I mean, come on, this is a violation of the Constitution.
An opponent of Proposal 1 says legalization of marijuana would be bad for Michigan.
If it's more accessible, it's going to filter into the hands of our younger people.
We hear about the Opportunity Atlas and Opportunity Bargain.
What that means is that for a lot less, you can get the same amount of opportunity if you grew up in that neighborhood, if you are a young black child.
It's really interesting social science. Then a new mural will be celebrated in Banglatown.
First and foremost, it's breathtaking. It's huge, and it is just the personification of Bangladeshi culture.
Plus, we're prepping you for election night coverage with drinks. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. It's fall, it's election season, time for the political roundup, and you know, our Friday commentators have seen a couple of elections in their lives, and we've been wondering, what do they think the candidates running for governor have been missing? So we're going to ask them. Vicki Barnett is the former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Ken Sikkema is senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican legislative leader. Just in case you haven't been paying attention, by the way, the candidates for governor are in alphabetical order: Libertarian Bill Gelinno, Republican Bill Schuette, and Democrat Gretchen Whitmer. So, Vicki, what do you think they should have been talking about that they haven't?
We haven't discussed revenue sharing and how the state politics affects our local communities. And there are so many ballot proposals from local communities on the ballot for public safety millages, for making sure that they can support their parks and recreation programs, and for road millages. It's striking to see how many of road millages are on the ballot in local communities, and that's because revenue sharing from the state to local communities has been cut. That means your tax dollars, which you pay to the state, which were supposed to come back to local governments, aren't making it back to their local governments, and so you have to pay again at the local level to support basic services, and that's a real, real problem. So I would have liked to hear a discussion about revenue sharing and how they view local governments in the current climate.
Ken, what about you? What are you not hearing that you'd like to hear from the gubernatorial candidates?
Well, actually, I think Vicki makes a good point. I think there just hasn't been any discussion at all about revenue sharing. There has been, to answer your question, there has been discussion about education, but I don't think it's dialed down enough to talk about the need for improving educational outcomes in Michigan and how we're going to do that. But I also will say that I have what I would call a realistic expectation about candidate discussion during an election year. I mean, they always are going to gravitate toward the easy issues and avoid the hard ones. And then when they do engage, it's always going to be sound bites. So I just think that kind of goes with the territory in a campaign season.
You know, there was a time when candidates would issue white papers about their positions. That happens a little bit once in a while these days, but that's helpful for voters who really want to know where these people are going. But now the white papers are almost reduced to sound bites. Is that something that we need to insist on from our candidates?
I think we are missing a lot of information from candidates. The current discussion through television ads and sound bites seem to be negative attacks that make no sense whatsoever and a reiteration of where the other party has failed. But there are issues that are rising to the top that we all are pretty keen on and getting answers to, and that is infrastructure repair for roads and for water and sewer systems. Education is one of the top issues. How are we going to continue to fund education, and should we have unaccountable charter schools? Those are big issues. And, of course, when we talk about the environment and our water systems and clean drinking water, those are the issues in healthcare especially, again, making sure that we can cover pre-existing conditions. Those are rising to the top. And we're also forgetting to talk about public transit. How do we get people who need to work if they can't afford a car and they can't afford the insurance on a car? And how do we grow the economy based on making sure that we have a reliable public transit system, and how do we draw new companies to Michigan? That was one of the big issues with the Amazon rejection of the state, was the fact that we had no reliable public transit system in all of our urban areas.
Ken, what would you do if you were a campaign manager for a gubernatorial candidate? How would you approach this? Is what they're doing the best way to get votes, or is there a better way?
No, I would do exactly what they're doing. Their candidates are always going to emphasize the issues that they believe will help them get elected, and they're going to avoid the issues that won't. I really think it's the job of the media to try to get the discussion going in a substantive way about issues. And frankly, I think the media this year in particular, but generally, does a pretty good job. I mean, you know, Michigan Radio, Bridge Magazine, the Detroit Journalism Cooperative, the Truth Squad, Michigan Truth Squad, which is part of Bridge. If you look at the coverage in the last several weeks and months, the media, I think, has done a pretty good job of trying to get the discussion on these substantive issues and matters. But it's just really hard to kind of get above the noise of campaigns and the ads.
Yeah, especially since most people are getting their news from Facebook these days. It's kind of tough to get through on the bigger, larger, more complex issues.
Yeah, it's a headline campaign. People run based on what they read in headlines.
Yeah. Well, let's hope that we've got a little more time and the candidates will dig into some of these bigger issues. But I guess, Ken, we're not really expecting that, right?
No, I mean, I think, like I said, I have sort of this realistic expectations of what candidates, particularly statewide candidates, are going to talk about and how they're going to talk about it during an election season.
Ken Sikkema is a former Republican legislator. Vicki Barnett is a former Democratic legislator. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lester.
Tonight will be the last game of the season for the Muskegon Heights Academy football team. The team has had a familiar sound back in the stands for the home games this season. After the school's marching band program was canceled several years ago, the band relaunched this fall. It started small, but it's growing. We sent our reporter Dustin Dwyer to last week's game to capture the sounds from the stands.
Yo, let's go.
I'm Darren McCall. I'm the director of bands at Muskegon Heights Public School Academy. Right now we are in the Muskegon Heights Media Center, which is the band room. We're getting prepared for the final home game. Yeah, we're just trying to get it together right now. We're going to have us some fun tonight. Right now we're just starting with drummers and dancers. I'm looking to get a 100-piece band by the spring. I'm a graduate of 2006 from here. I was in a band, and I know how great the band was, how great we were. A lot of these kids have seen it, and I know they're begging for it to come back.
Take it! Come on, take it!
Usually around kickoff or first or second quarters, everybody starts showing up because, like they said, you know, halftime is game time for us. So that's how it is. I am Monica Hildrick. I am the majorette coach. They dance in the stands. And when they dance in the stand, they dance. They're not playing around with them. They actually are dancing, and they're dancing hard, full out. They're loving every minute of it.
My name is Jahara Jones, and my daughter, she's a majorette. Her name is Deasia Hollins. I'm also the Flag Girls coach.
The band always been the spirit of Heights, and we trying to bring that back because I think we kind of lost our soul. But now that our band back, I feel like it's even improved. Even the little 3 weeks that we've been performing for the football team and the school and such, it's been awesome.
My name is Christopher Cooper, and I'm in the eighth grade, and I'm 14 years old, and I'm in a band. It's fun. We get to go to games, and stuff like that. We have fun at practice. I'm sticking with Ben for the rest of my life.
This band is so much fun, so much excitement. The heart, the heartbeat, if you haven't heard that phrase yet, of Muskegon Heights. It's hope. It's the future. Renee Garcia, superintendent. I'm ready for some more instruments, right? So right now we've got the drum line and the dancers, but being able to expand that to some horns.
Mr. McCall, we got horns coming by basketball season? Is that
yes. Right? Yes.
Really?
Monday, we're supposed to start instrument players. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. So.
Wait. You can take a trombone player and get him from brand new to the pep band by basketball season?
By basketball season. I would definitely do that. Yes.
All right.
It's going to happen.
Basketball season for the Muskegon Heights High School Academy starts in January. If you want to catch the band in the meantime, they'll be playing at the home games for the Muskegon Lumberjacks minor league hockey team. That story was produced by Dustin Dwyer. Coming up, marijuana opponents say legalizing pot on election day would be bad for Michigan.
It's hard for employers to get good workers. You have to pass a drug screen. Many people would be disqualified, keeping people out of the job market. And I think we want our citizens to be productive and contributing to society, not a drag on society.
That's after the break. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. Stick around. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. On the November 6th ballot, there will be a statewide proposal to make recreational use of marijuana legal. It's called Proposal 1. Advocates say making pot legal will have all kinds of benefits, including increasing tax revenues for the state. Opponents of Proposal 1 say the legalization of recreational use of marijuana is bad for Michigan. Brian Ellis is a businessman and part of a committee called Healthy and Productive Michigan. He joins us now. So why do you feel recreational use of marijuana would be detrimental to the state?
I just don't think it's good for our society as a whole. The marijuana industry sort of targets and preys upon youth. In my opinion, in our society, I've been on a local public school board, and you know the data and the research shows that the younger you start experimenting with pot, the more likely you are to move on to harder drugs. And we have an opioid epidemic in our country, and I don't think we should make any moves that would further that.
Yeah, the research is varied on that, but I agree with you. There have been studies like that. You said commercialization of marijuana would go after kids. On what do you base that?
Well, I mean, if it's more accessible, it's going to filter into the hands of our younger people. I mean, that's just kind of a basic fact. If you see that, if you look at alcohol, just because the legal age is 18 doesn't mean that kids at 16 are not, that they don't have access to it. So that's where I'm coming from.
I've been looking at some of your op-eds and some of the concerns that have been expressed. One, you say it'll be a strain on the economy. In what way?
Well, I think the obvious revenue that comes in from that is there that's more concrete, but there's a lot of hidden costs. I mean, the economy, and thanks to good things going on in our state, the economy is running kind of full tilt, but it's hard for employers to get good workers. You have to pass a drug screen. Many people would be disqualified. They would stay on, say, maybe the welfare rolls, if you will, because they can't qualify, in my opinion, if marijuana is legalized. So it just has this whole effect of kind of keeping people out of the job market, and I think we want our citizens to be productive and contributing to society, not a drag on society if they can, and I don't see how marijuana helps in that regard.
The business leaders I've talked to indicate that that's already happening. It's black market pot, yes, it's not legal, yes, but they still can't pass the drug test, so I'm not sure what changes then.
Well, I think more people would not pass the drug test. That's where I'm coming from. I agree with what you just said, but I don't think we need to make it ever that more easier to get your hands on. And, you know, how is our society helped if we have more people walking around in an impaired state?
You also noted that you'd expect an increase in criminal activity. In what way?
Well, I'm not an expert in this area, but it's, you know, the whole drug culture and the drug dealing causes issues in our society. Kind of back to my original point, if it puts us further down the road of moving on to harder drugs, which I believe it does, that has huge costs to our society that aren't good.
As I listen to the concerns about the use of marijuana, they're pretty much the same concerns about the use of alcohol. The war against marijuana has been pretty much a laid-back, decades-long version of prohibition. If you successfully persuade voters to vote no on Proposal 1, how long do you think it will be before marijuana is legalized nationally? I mean, we just saw that happen in Canada.
Right. Well, I liken that just because your neighbor runs off and makes a mistake doesn't mean you have to run off and make the same mistake.
I guess what I'm getting to is we're seeing states start to more rapidly address this and embrace the legalization of recreational marijuana.
Sure. Some states have. Colorado, for instance, and I know people that live in that state, and they say it's not good. When I visited the state, you can't walk down the street without walking through a haze of marijuana in certain places, and it's just not a good thing. And I don't think that's panned out the way they predicted it would be. And I don't see why Michigan has to rush into this. And the national legalization to me is a completely separate debate. We have before us a choice here coming up in early November, and I think the clear choice is to vote no on this Proposal 1.
Brian Ellis, the CEO of Brooktree Capital Management and part of the group Healthy and Productive Michigan. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
This week, we've been interviewing candidates for Attorney General. On Morning Edition, we heard Democrat Dana Nessel and Republican Tom Leonard. On Stateside earlier this week, we heard the independent candidate, Chris Grevlin. And today, we're talking with the Libertarian candidate for Attorney General, Lisa Lane Gioia. Welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start off with how you would run the office of the Attorney General. There's been a fair amount of time and effort spent to oppose federal government actions when the president is from the opposite party. Will you be joining lawsuits against the feds when the administration does something that goes against your party's principles?
First of all, let's go back to the party's principles. The Libertarian Party has two major principles, and that's the non-aggression principle, which is don't hurt people and don't take their stuff, and the principle of self-ownership, which is live and let live. Those are basic rights. We all have basic rights to property, life, and freedom and everything like that. And that's what the law is. The law is designed to protect those. So the idea of putting political bias into this role, into this office that should not be biased in the least bit, in order to use it, in order to play with it, in order to kick a political football around, is disgusting to me. It's the application of the law in defense of the citizens. That's what the AG is supposed to be doing.
On your website, you indicate providing a check and balance against overreach by the governor and the legislature is a duty of the attorney general. Can you give me an example of the kind of overreach you've seen from them?
Well, this is just an example. Look at our auto insurance. It's disgusting, isn't it? And at the end of 2017, they tried to get a bill through, pushing a bill through, trying to get some auto insurance reform. It failed. So what did Mike Duggan do? Mike Duggan brought a lawsuit up against this. Now, this is actually something that the legislators should have done. They should be looking out for the people, but they're not. They're paid for by special interests, and a lot of those special interests are paying for to maintain the system that we currently have. So in this case, with this lawsuit that Mike Duggan has brought about, I would tend to try to be looking at this in a way that would favor the citizens and in favor more freedom for the citizens and in determining whether, in fact, this is a violation of the Constitution. Because if the legislators aren't doing anything, then it's up to someone else to protect the people. And that's what the AG can do.
Proposal 1 is on the ballot. Some law enforcement personnel around the state have been stating legalizing recreational use of marijuana would be a bad step for Michigan. What are your views on the proposal, and what should happen if marijuana use continues to be a criminal offense?
You know what? I never even considered that it would continue. I am assuming, perhaps naively, I'm trusting in the intelligence of the Michigan public in passing this proposal. The war on drugs has been a horrible failure. Prohibition is not working. What we're ending up with is ghettoizing our urban areas. You're ending up prosecuting people for use of a plant that has known medicinal benefits in seizures and PTSD and weaning people from opiate addictions. So I had just assumed that it would pass because of the general trend of people towards more sanity. We've seen it happen in Colorado. Look what happened to our neighbors north and south of us in Canada. So if it does not pass, I suppose a continuation of the laws, which I am not happy about, but hopefully it will pass, and hopefully we will have the right to be able to choose what to do with our bodies and to not have laws that force our quote-unquote morals on other people.
The 65-year-old Enbridge Line 5 pipeline that lies on the bottom of the Straits of Mackinac will continue to operate while plans move ahead forward for an underground tunnel, which could take years if it's actually pursued. What, if anything, would you do about Line 5 in the meantime?
What we hear, and this is just wonderful, so typical from the right, who probably, if you looked at their PACs and everything, they might be getting a little bit of money from petroleum companies, is it's fine, don't worry. And from the left, it's shut it down automatically. You've got these two diametrically opposed extreme partisan views. This is what I would do. Right now, I'm looking at a pipeline assessment. This is from 2016 from the La Montagne Pipeline Assessment Corporation. And what they did in their overview, they were looking at the criticality of any circumferential or girth weld crack-like anomalies, including potential interactions with metal loss or dents, and they were looking for circumferentially oriented cracking. Now, this is what the Office of the AG should be doing. Investigating this. You've got a team of investigators there. You don't just throw this very important issue into a political machine. This is a matter of physics. This is a matter of science. Look at the facts, and each case that's brought before the office should be treated as this. Look at the facts, look at the statistics, and then make an informed judgment without bias on the basis of facts in consideration of what the potential will be. Yes, if we keep it open, is there a potential of an environmental disaster? I don't know. Let's look at the structural deficiencies of it. If we shut it down, what would the economic impacts be? That you have to consider as well. Those are all thrown under the bus for politicians who aren't really concerned about that, who are just concerned about a nice soundbite.
Governor Snyder has asked Attorney General Bill Schuette to file a lawsuit against 3M, one of the manufacturers of a product containing PFAS chemicals. Those chemicals are contaminating drinking water and fish in different spots across the state, more than 50. So far, Schuette has not filed a suit against 3M. What would you do if a governor asked you to do something like that?
Again, same thing. This is the first I've ever heard of it. So go through the facts. It comes down to the facts. It doesn't matter what the governor says. If the governor recommends something, of course. I mean, this would be a serious problem if proven true. So let's take a look at this. Also, when we say let's take a look at this, you're talking about calling in a lot of it. There are investigators at the office, of course, but a lot of money is going to be spent in commissioning studies and stuff like that. Look what we've got here. We've got U of M. We've got MSU. We have CMU, EMU. We have, better than anything, Michigan Tech, Ferris, Northwood. These institutions that we have, why couldn't their professors assign to their students a project of simulation, of studying of what's going on in here? We could accumulate so much more data this way and get our students involved in this process too. But again, it's on the basis of a consideration of facts. And these are scientific, statistical, mathematical, physical facts. Politics has nothing to do with it.
In this state, LGBTQ folks can legally be discriminated against. You can't, as Attorney General, change the Elliott Larson Civil Rights Act to include LGBTQ folks. Only legislature and the governor can do that. But there are opportunities for the Attorney General to issue opinions when there's a question of interpreting the law. How do you view the LGBTQ civil rights issue?
Considering all of the subsets, groups that are protected under Elliott Larson, it just makes sense to include the LGBT community in there. And so to me, I know this sounds strange, but to me, discriminating against someone for their race, for their religion, for their sexual preference, to me, makes about as much sense as discriminating against them because of their zodiac sign. It just doesn't make sense. I want to know the individual. I want to know who you are. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't think that way, and that's the role of the law to protect them. So yes, I would be coming down on the side, to the extent that the Constitution allows, in favor of a more open society. But again, you're bound by the Constitution. So the best thing that the AG could do in this situation is say, hey, bring it to the public's attention. Bring it to the legislators' attention. This is not right. What are you going to do about it? Fix it. Fix it. Amend Elliott Larson. Why shouldn't these groups be included?
Law enforcement can seize money and property suspected of being gotten through illegal gains. The agencies get the proceeds of the seized property. There might never be a conviction or even charges filed. The people who own it have to go through an arduous legal process to get their property back under civil asset forfeiture. What do you think of that as a tool of law enforcement?
I'm sorry, I don't even know how to answer that other than a little bit of vomit coming up in my throat. I mean, come on, this is a violation of the Constitution. You can't do that. You cannot seize assets unless someone was convicted of a crime. And it's being done. And that is something that's definitely going to have to change.
Lisa Lane Gioia is the Libertarian candidate running for Attorney General. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon of Tammy's Tastings. Michigan Radio got a hold of you and said, hey, Election Day is coming up. We think there ought to be a couple of drinks, but they wanted, and this is so strange for us, no alcohol versions of them. You call them mocktails.
Right. And mocktails can be every bit as delicious as cocktails, and everyone can drink them.
How did you decide, here's the perfect kind of drinks to make on Election Day?
Well, of course, we had to have a blue drink and a red drink.
So we've got two drinks here. What are they called?
So one is the Blue Wave, and the other is the Red Refresher.
Let's start with the Red Refresher. How do you make that?
So both of these drinks are easy drinking, light, refreshing drinks that can be mixed up in pitchers so you can serve them to all your friends during your election party. For the Red Refresher, it's some mint leaves that I muddled in the bottom of a pint glass with an ounce of simple syrup. And then I added an ounce of lime juice and then 6 ounces of a raspberry zinger tea. So this was a tea that I brewed in advance and let cool down. Tea is a great addition to a mocktail because it adds a lot of flavor without adding sweetness. And that's one of the big challenges when we make non-alcoholic drinks. How do you have them still be flavorful but not too sweet?
And it is red. The Red Refresher is actually literally red.
Right. So it's a hibiscus-based tea, and any hibiscus-based tea will work for this. But it's really bright and refreshing all on its own. And then when you add these other ingredients, it just amps it up a notch.
Okay. And the other one was the Blue Wave.
So the Blue Wave, well, as you know, there are really no blue ingredients in the world. So this is a riff on a lemonade, in particular a kind of Tunisian lemonade that I encountered in some travels over the summer. So it's lemon juice, an ounce of lemon juice, 3/4 of an ounce of simple syrup, 1/4 teaspoon of orange flower water. So this is a common ingredient in North Africa, in Mediterranean cuisines, and adds just a really nice roundness to this drink. And then I top that off with 6 ounces of club soda. And both of these just get mixed in the pint glass you're going to drink them in, fill it up with ice to the top, and you're ready to go.
Well, if there are no blue ingredients, why is the drink so blue?
Oh, that's right. I did add 1 drop of blue food coloring.
So on election day, or election night, I should say, and I find out my candidate wins, and I want to add a little alcohol to my mocktail and make it a real cocktail, what could I substitute?
So I think the Red Refresher works really well with white rum, or you could use vodka as well. And the Blue Wave I like with gin or with vodka. And for both of those, you would just take out 2 ounces of the main non-alcoholic ingredient, so the tea for the Red Refresher and the club soda for the Blue Wave, and substitute in the alcohol of your choice.
What do you have for the Libertarians?
Well, I hear the Libertarians are really hot right now on something that you can't exactly put in the glass. So lacking a particular herb in my kitchen, I couldn't mix much up for them.
Well, cheers anyway.
Cheers.
Still to come, a new mural goes up between Detroit and Hamtramck to celebrate the Bangladeshi community.
It is really important that we find avenues to represent the beauty of our differences, right? Represent the reasons why we are important and it's important for us to be here.
This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. Hi, I'm Lester Graham. There's a new large mural being painted on a building on the border of Detroit and Hamtramck. The area is known as Banglatown because it's home to so many Bangladeshi Americans. Joining me now is Farha Hanif, who is with the Bangladeshi American Mural Committee. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much, Lester.
So give me an idea what the mural illustrates. What's it look like?
First and foremost, it's breathtaking. It's huge. We have a wall of approximately 50 by 45 feet on the side of a school, and it is just the personification of Bangladeshi culture in art form, right? The colors are vibrant. There's red and green, which is the colors of our flag, everywhere. It has imagery of landscape and tea gardens, which are very significant in the country itself. We have imagery of the tiger, the Royal Bengal tiger, which is the national animal that we all rally around. There is an image of a little Bangladeshi girl, which is really, you know, kind of instills hope in everyone and kind of what we want to have as the theme kind of behind our mural, that feeling of hope. And I think that all of the imagery, including her wrapped around, is what you will see immediately when you look at the wall.
The muralist is Victor Quinones.
Right.
AKA Marca 27. How did you find Marca 27?
In our process of looking for an artist, our first and foremost choice of selecting an artist was to find someone of Bangladeshi background. Only because we're trying to paint a Bangladeshi mural, we wanted someone who would immediately understand our culture and would be able to portray it in a beautiful form on a mural. When we were looking for one, because the idea, even though we are a people that is very artistically inclined and does appreciate art, the idea of murals in general is not something that is very prevalent in our country. There's not huge
literally
pieces.
A foreign concept.
Exactly. Yeah. It is a foreign concept. So to find an artist that has experience doing things like that in this caliber was very difficult. So what we did next was kind of broaden our horizon and look at really the best muralists in the world, right? We didn't have a limit to what we were looking for. We were looking for someone who could get the job done and in the best possible way. So Marka blew us away from the very beginning, and it really was fitting for us because he is of Mexican heritage, and a lot of his murals, if you look at, he uses those vibrant colors, and he's wonderful at painting people of color, and there's a lot of overlap between Mexican culture and Bangladeshi culture. So
in what way?
I mean, just values in general. If you look at Mexican heritage and Bangladeshi heritage, we are very family-oriented people. We have huge families, and there's no... Probably the thing that we always bond over is food. You go to someone's house and you're fed like there's no tomorrow, right? So we love our food, we love our family, we're very loud, open people.
When you were deciding this mural, did you have any restrictions or plans? I mean, I'm just trying to wonder, because it could have been anything.
Yeah.
It could have included a lot of religious symbols. It could have included a lot of political figures.
Yeah.
How did you go about deciding what it should and should not include?
Yeah. So the biggest restriction for us was the fact that we wanted this mural to be accepted by all. Obviously, with art, you can't make everyone happy, but you need to understand that if you're creating a mural for the community, inside the community, you want the community to be involved. You want the community to be aware of it. And you want the community to eventually accept it and celebrate it. So in terms of imagery restrictions, the process that we laid out was we invited all of the Bangladeshi community that we could find, right? In Hamtramck, in Detroit, in the suburbs, in Rochester, in Ann Arbor, wherever we knew that there were Bangladeshi people, we invited them to come to our town hall meetings. And we had two of those. And we asked them, what do you want to see on the mural? Our mindset was, we're not going to include any religious imagery. We're not going to include any political imagery, because those are the most decisive things that can divide a country, even though Bangladesh is a largely Muslim country. There are still lots of Hindus, lots of Buddhists, lots of Christians in that country. So we didn't want any symbol that would kind of alienate or isolate another community.
You know, when I heard that you had held these town halls, I thought that's a really good idea, because someone donated some signs to Banglatown last year.
Right.
And they weren't received all that well. In fact, they were vandalized.
Actually, what was funny is when we had our first town hall, that was the day after that vandalism happened. So we thought, wow, you know, we really don't want that to happen to our mural. And, you know, murals get vandalized all the time. That's, you know, just something with public art. But, you know, if we're doing something for the community, you want the community to have its input. And that's what we did with the town halls. We asked them, what do you want to see from those ideas that we collected and the suggestions we collected? We consolidated the list based off of like how many, the frequency of them coming up. And then we communicated that with the artists.
Here's the big question.
Yeah.
Why did you want to do this? Why was this important to your community?
Yeah. So it's kind of a twofold answer for me. Personally, I had a personal reason and then cultural reason, I guess. Personally, my dad was a part of One Hamtramck. But 5 years ago, when the Yemeni mural was completed, he was working with the executive director of One Hamtramck, Bill Meyer, to complete this project, to bring a mural about for the Bangladeshi community. And unfortunately, 2 years ago, he passed away. And at that time, when they were looking to complete this project, they couldn't find an artist. They ran into the same hiccups that we kind of ran into, but the project kind of got stalled. And then he passed away, and they weren't able to complete it. So when my dad passed away, we had a memorial service. And in memory of him, we kind of restarted this whole project. That being set aside, with why I got personally involved, this project in general is, I think, in today's, at any time, but in today's political climate especially, when there's a lot of heat, there's a lot of mistrust and negative connotations associated with immigrants, associated with people of color, associated with just people who are different in general, it is really important that we find avenues to represent the beauty of our differences, right? Represent the reasons why we are important, and it's important for us to be here. I think it's a great statement to tell people that, you know, we're kind of here and we're not going anywhere, that, you know, it emphasizes the contributions that we've made to society, that there are a lot of us here. We're unalarming. We're, you know, we're not going to do anything to you, but we're here in large numbers. And look, you know, it's a piece of art. It's hard to hate. It's something that anybody from any ethnicity could appreciate, but it's also they're appreciating your culture at the same time.
The Bangladeshi mural celebration will take place this Sunday in front of the wall. It's at Bridge Academy, West at 3105 Carpenter Street in Hamtramck, and that happens at 2 o'clock on Sunday, right?
Yes, yep.
Farha Hanif, thanks for stopping by and talking with us.
Thank you so much, Lester.
Rethinking how neighborhoods work. Some Harvard researchers recently merged census data with Internal Revenue Service data for the entire country. They found that some underprivileged kids from one neighborhood are doing much better in life than underprivileged kids from what appears to be a statistically identical neighborhood. In fact, for some kids, it's about which side of the street you grew up on, literally. Tanvi Misra took the look at what's being called the Opportunity Atlas and focused on Detroit for an article published in CityLab. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
So why did you choose to drill down on the Detroit area?
Detroit was really interesting just, you know, in terms of its economic history. It's also interesting because one of the people who's been working on this research is formerly from the mayor's office in Detroit and has been looking at economic development at that level and sort of really thinking carefully about the policies and interventions for young kids growing up in Detroit. You know, we all know the history of Detroit, and it's been through its financial troubles and the poverty levels for kids have really been a deterrent to success and to economic opportunity further in life. And so I think, you know, it was just an interesting city in terms of, you know, how it looks compared to the suburbs around it, how it looks compared to other cities in the Midwest because of its particular history. So that's why I wanted to focus on Detroit. Plus having that, you know, particular perspective of someone who worked in city government who has now then been doing research with and policy interventions with the team that's been working on the Opportunity Atlas was a really key. So I think for all of those reasons, Detroit was an interesting case study.
Well, geographically, it's a huge city. I'm wondering what neighborhoods caught your attention and why.
Yes. So, you know, one of the things that struck me when I first looked at a map of Detroit in the Opportunity Atlas was how much worse if you sort of looked at children as a whole, sort of if you didn't break it down by race, how much worse outcomes looked for kids in the city compared to the suburbs. But then you sort of break it down by race. And when you're looking specifically at low-income Black kids growing up in the city and comparing them to outcomes for Black kids nationwide, the picture looks a lot more nuanced. So there are certain neighborhoods that are doing much better in terms of providing just a ladder to a better life than others. And they look quite similar. So a lot of them from the map, if you sort of play around with the map, a lot of them are in the northwest of Detroit. One that really stood out was Rosedale-Grandmont area, North Rosedale Park specifically. These areas seem to be much bluer, and blue in the map suggested that they had better outcomes, so better economic outcomes when they were in their mid-30s. So that was one neighborhood that really struck me.
Well, Grandmont Rosedale, let me stop you at Grandmont Rosedale, because it's, you know, it's a very nice area, very nice housing in Detroit. How does it compare to the neighborhoods surrounding it that they're doing so much better than what looks to be an economically identical neighborhood near it?
Right. So, you know, the difference was in thousands of dollars per year. A child growing up in that area could be making much more than their peers just in the surrounding area. So not even, you know, a mile or two apart. That was what was so striking, was that these differences can be extremely stark just across the census tract boundary. Another neighborhood that, you know, I wanted to highlight was Sherwood Forest, which, you know, I feel like people in Detroit know it as a neighborhood with sort of stately homes and, you know, quite a close-knit community. And some of those factors coming together really make it one of the best places to live in the city for young Black kids specifically.
Another neighborhood that you noted was Springwells Village. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So that was really interesting to me too. Springwells Village actually offers the same in terms of income to young Black kids as Sherwood Forest. And they're very, very different in terms of economic demographic profile, right? So, and also very significantly, they're very different in terms of rent. So, you know, it's just really interesting. What Springwell Village really signifies is an opportunity bargain, according to this data set. What that means is that for a lot less, you can get the same amount of opportunity
if you grew up in that neighborhood, if you are a young Black child. Now, that could differ for different kids of different races. What this data set shows is that, for example, that might not be the same outcome provided to young Hispanic kids or young white kids.
Right. I understand that there's a heavy Latino-Latina population in Spring Mills Village. And I'm just wondering how that affects a Black kid's upbringing. I mean, I guess the real question is, we're seeing these results. Do we know why?
That's a really good question. And, you know, the researchers were very, very careful not to make any conclusive determinations on that front. What they feel that this data set provides is a springboard to dive deeper. So we don't know exactly what's happening in Spring Wells Village. It could be a number of things. It could be the fact that it has a really high percentage of married families. So families with, you know, both parents in the household or in the community, right? So you have more role models. It could be something intangible and sort of harder to suss out as that. It could be that it has more churches that provide certain kinds of services. There's so many things that are happening under the radar that what this data set really does is helps policymakers at a local level really dig deeper and find interventions that are specifically tailored to that neighborhood, or once they find out what's happening there, be able to replicate it elsewhere.
Right. The idea is not to move the kids into a higher achieving neighborhood, but to find out why it's performing better and try to improve poorer performing neighborhoods, right?
Right. I mean, it's a combination of both, right? So, for example, in Seattle, the city is really using this data set to foster neighborhood housing voucher choice, right? So they have this housing voucher program that helps low-income families move to better, higher opportunity neighborhoods. And when you think about this idea of having neighborhoods that offer opportunity bargains, right? So you don't have to go to the most expensive neighborhood, but what the city can do is help foster a choice where low-income families are then moving to a neighborhood that's not as expensive, but offers the same amount of opportunity. So that's one thing that you could do. The other thing you could also do is that you could look at exactly what's happening in these neighborhoods that are providing. So, you know, you have Sherwood Forest. What's happening in Sherwood Forest? Is it the housing? Is it the schools? Is it something else? And once you figure that out, then you take those findings and you apply them elsewhere to neighborhoods that are not doing that well.
You mentioned cities are looking at this. I'm wondering if philanthropies are paying attention to this opportunity atlas.
Oh, absolutely. The Kresge Foundation is one of the foundations that I've spoken to in my reporting. And they've been following the work of these researchers for a very long time. And it's really changed the way that they think about how they're designing their interventions and what they're funding at a local level. And now what this new research allows them to do is it helps them really get granular. So at a neighborhood level, you know, earlier they were sort of thinking of it as these big picture findings that were sort of hazy on a city level. But now they can really go to one neighborhood and they can be like, oh, okay, what's happening here? And then, you know, design sort of early childhood development interventions. They can design parks with educational programs. They can, you know, fund better libraries. All of these different interventions that they can really tailor to what's going on in that neighborhood.
Tavi Misra wrote the article, The Neighborhoods That Offer a Bargain on Upward Mobility. You can find it at citylab.com. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Next week on Stateside, we're going to bring you the first episode of Believed. That's Michigan Radio's podcast in collaboration with NPR. Before we end the show today, let's take a listen to a trailer about the podcast.
Larry Nassar abused women and girls for more than 20 years.
With disturbing news in the world of elite gymnastics, the former team doctor...
And a lot of people, they think they know this story.
Dozens of survivors shared their stories in court over...
And basically giving him more than a century in jail.
But serial predators don't just get away because of sloppy police work or inept institutions. They get away because we let them.
Those fears go through your head the whole time. What if I'm not believed?
If there were ever a moment to ask, what does it take for women to be believed? That moment is now. From Michigan Radio and NPR, this is Believed. I'm Kate Wells.
And I'm Lindsay Smith. And this is the story of how Larry Nassar got away with it for so long. You'll hear from survivors.
Everyone would just say, like, he's just touchy, like, he's a little weird.
You'll hear from parents.
I remember out of the corner of my eye seeing what looked to be potentially an erection.
You'll hear from police.
You know, we could have went to a doctor and said, is this a, you know, what is your thoughts on this medical procedure?
You could have, or you guys probably should have. Or is that clear?
Well, we should have. That's something that we should have done.
And you'll hear from Larry himself when he gets away and when he's finally cornered.
You know, I'm not purposely trying to get arousal from doing any treatment. I mean, come on.
We all think we'd be able to spot a predator like Larry Nassar.
We'll show you how even well-meaning adults failed to recognize Larry's abuse and how you could have missed it too.
Believed is a story of how survivors found their power and raised their voices, even in the face of doubt.
Little girls don't stay little forever. They grow into strong women that return to destroy your world.
Believed, coming October 22nd. Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts.
For more information, you can go to our website, michiganradio.org/believed.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Rusty Brock, who, when I asked him who he's engineering today, sounded a little bit like Eeyore. Oh, bother. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.